So, if you buy one of those extreme heavy-duty water purification systems for your house, like the kind that uses intense reverse osmosis, it strips absolutely everything out of the water. I mean, the toxins, the heavy metals, but also the good minerals, the bad minerals, everything.
Right, yeah, it's a completely uncompromising binary process.
Right.
The system just it doesn't tolerate even a fraction of a percent of contamination.
Exactly. You run tap water through it and you are left with nothing but plain, mathematically pure H2O. But the catch is, humans actually need some of those trace minerals to survive, you know? The friction, the complexity of natural water is, well, it's part of what makes it hydrating in the first place.
Yeah, but if you're terrified of contamination, I mean, you just strip all of that away, regardless of the cost.
Right. And that brings us to our deep dive today, because back in April 2026, an author named Chen Shaloff published this fiercely argued Hebrew manifesto, and he's essentially attempting to apply that exact same extreme reverse osmosis process, but to the human mind.
Yes, and his very first step is demanding the outright ban of some of the most famous beloved texts in traditional Jewish history, which means we are looking at a deeply polarizing document today.
Oh, extremely polarizing, which is why we need to lay down a marker right now before we jump in. For you listening, we need to make this super clear. This source material contains highly aggressive criticisms of mainstream Jewish practices and some very revered historical figures.
Exactly. And our goal here today is absolutely not to take a side. We're not endorsing the author's views, and we're not validating his teardown of traditional Judaism either.
Right. Whether it leans left or right, we are entirely neutral here. Our job today is strictly to unpack this fascinating, uncompromising worldview. We're just acting as intellectual architects, analyzing the blueprints to understand how this author's logic actually works.
Because honestly, it's a fascinating look at information control.
It really is. I mean, whether you are trying to optimize your own learning habits or you're just trying to navigate today's crushing information overload, you have probably wondered how to effectively filter out all the noise. And, well, this author takes filtering to a level most people can't even fathom.
Yeah, he really does.
So, okay, let's unpack this. What is the fundamental driving philosophy behind this entire curriculum? Like, why so much hostility toward these standard texts?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the foundation of his argument rests on a very rigid theory of knowledge. For him, learning is absolutely not an open-ended exploration.
Not at all.
No, he's motivated by this profound, almost existential dread that human time is dangerously limited. Because you only have so many hours on this earth, you know? So wasting time on anything less than absolute undeniable certainty is a tragedy to him.
He explicitly tells his readers to only invest energy in studying things that leave literally zero room for doubt. He wants to guarantee that tomorrow, the foundation of your knowledge won't suddenly be questioned or undermined by a new piece of information.
Right. And he acknowledges that humans make mistakes. But he draws this massive impenetrable wall between two very specific types of errors.
Oh, right, the point mistake versus the consistent error.
Exactly. He describes a point mistake as just a slight negligible error, like a typo in a textbook, or maybe a momentarily misquoted date. A smart person sees a point mistake and easily skips over it without losing the plot.
But then there's the second category, right? What he calls the consistent error. And this is a fundamentally crooked path of logic. He argues that consistent errors don't just give you the wrong answer on a test.
No, they do much worse.
Yeah, they introduce what he translates as false imaginations or hallucinations into the human mind. For this author, bad information isn't just wrong, it's a pathogen.
It's a virus. He believes it spiritually corrupts the student and just completely destroys their grasp on reality.
It's like an ultra-strict dietary cleanse, but for your brain. No junk food, no artificial ingredients, no empty calories, only pure, unfiltered nutrients.
But I struggle with that premise a bit.
Also. Well, isn't learning inherently about making mistakes? Like, if you never encounter a bad idea, how do you learn the critical thinking skills required to recognize one out in the wild?
Right, but you're describing the modern liberal arts approach to education. You know, we teach the debate. We expose students to a marketplace of ideas so they can stress test their own beliefs.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, our author completely and utterly rejects that premise for the layman. He believes the average person's mind is simply too fragile to handle that kind of stress test.
Oh, wow. So he thinks people just can't handle it.
Yeah. He argues that if you introduce a compelling but false idea to a weak mind, the hallucination will take root. The mind gets seduced. Therefore, For him, the only solution is to completely sterilize the educational environment from day one.
Which is wild. Mm-hmm. And to achieve that sterile environment, he starts by entirely restructuring how a person reads the most foundational text of all, the Bible.
Right. He dictates a highly rigid daily routine.
Yeah, for the Torah, the five books of Moses, he instructs the reader to go incredibly slowly. You read the Hebrew text twice, focusing deeply on the exact pronunciation and the strict intent of the verses.
And then, immediately after that second reading, you are required to read the Aramaic translation by Onkelos. He actually elevates Onkelos above all other commentaries, calling him the interpreter of truth.
Which is a heavy title, but the mechanism here is crucial, right?
Absolutely. A translation, specifically a highly literal, authoritative one like Onkelos, acts as a heavy guardrail. It tells the reader exactly what the text means in that specific context.
It severely limits the mind's ability to wander off into speculative or creative interpretation. And he applies that same mathematical pacing to the rest of the Bible, too, the prophets and the writings.
Yeah, he calculates there are roughly 750 chapters in those sections. So he mandates reading half a chapter a day.
Which locks the student into a five-year cycle. And for this journey, you use the Targum Yonatan translation as your absolute base. You just do not stray from it.
Which sounds disciplined, sure, but fairly standard for a rigorous study program.
Right, until he drops the absolute bombshell. He institutes a total, uncompromising ban on reading Rashi.
Yeah, that is the directive that completely upends the traditional study model.
I mean, for anyone listening who is familiar with traditional Jewish text study, Rashi is the gold standard. His commentary is printed right next to the biblical text in almost every standard edition worldwide.
It's everywhere.
Banning him is functionally equivalent to a literature professor banning Shakespeare, or like a physics teacher demanding you never read Newton. What is the actual mechanism behind his grievance with Rashi?
Well, the author's anger stems from the tension between literalism and allegory. He demands absolute clarity from his texts. If a verse is meant to be taken literally, he expects the commentary to reinforce that literal meaning.
And if it's an allegory?
If a verse is an allegory or a metaphor or a dream sequence, he demands a glaring warning label, something telling the reader, hey, this is not literal history.
And the problem is, Rashi notoriously blends Peshat, which is the literal contextual meaning of the text, with Drash, the allegorical, mystical, or homiletical teachings of the earlier sages.
Exactly. And Rashi weaves them together completely seamlessly. You might be reading a dry historical account of Moses on a mountain, and suddenly Rashi introduces a midrash about a flying mountain or a talking rock.
Right. And Rashi doesn't put up a neon sign saying, just a heads up, this next part is a poetic metaphor to teach a moral lesson.
And to our author, that seamlessness is incredibly dangerous. He accuses Rashi of taking the clear meaning of the Torah and twisting it into something opaque and confusing.
Because by mixing myth with history without those warning labels, Rashi injects those hallucinations directly into the hearts of readers, especially children and youth who just don't have the cognitive development to separate the literal from the metaphorical yet.
Yeah. He goes as far as blaming Rashi's devoted followers for actually institutionalizing these hallucinations.
Oh, right. The Mazor Vitri.
Yes. He specifically calls out a text called the Masor Vitri, which was compiled by Rashi's students. It gathered laws and prayers, but it also included the folklore and the homiletical traditions.
And the author sees that as the exact moment the water supply was permanently contaminated with superstition, because people today treat Rashi's commentary as if it were divine law handed down at Mount Sinai alongside the Torah itself.
Exactly. The author constantly has to remind his readers that Rashi was a medieval man. He's not a prophet. So the author replaces Rashi with a highly vetted roster of strict rationalist commentators.
Like Ibn Ezra, who is basically the medieval equivalent of a strict constitutional originalist.
Very much so.
Ibn Ezra didn't care about the folklore or the mystical meaning. He cared about the grammar, the syntax, and the math of the text. And the author also highly recommends the Radak, calling him 99% clean with straight logic.
Because the Radak functions exactly the way the author wants a commentator to function. When the Radak encounters a strange, anthropomorphic, or difficult verse, he acts like a check engine light.
Oh, I love that analogy.
Yeah, he steps in, stops the reader, and explicitly states, warning, this is strange, it cannot be taken literally, and here is how we rationalize it. He also permits the use of the Metsudat Zion, but strictly as a dictionary for defining complex words.
Nothing more. Keep it simple. Keep it literal. But That intense fear of allegory, that absolute dread of misinterpretation, it pushes the author to take an even more radical step.
Oh, yes.
Because if you thought banning Rashi was explosive, wait until you hear his approach to the core of traditional Jewish learning. He tells everyday people to completely abandon the daily study of the Talmud.
I mean, the entire image of the traditional Jewish scholar is someone hunched over a massive volume of the Talmud, swaying, debating, unpacking incredibly dense hypothetical scenarios.
Right.
And our author looks at that image and says, stop doing this. He claims the Talmud, both the Babylonian and the Jerusalem editions, was never meant for the general public to read as part of a daily routine.
He views the Talmud as an inherently dangerous text for an untrained mind. We can think of it as like the danger of the draft, because the Talmud isn't a clean, polished rulebook.
Not at all.
It's a messy, sprawling transcript of centuries of arguments, dissenting opinions, rejected legal theories, and those dense parables called the Agada.
Yeah. Handing the Talmud to a layman, in his view, is like handing a massive medical encyclopedia filled with disproven 19th century theories mixed in with modern treatments to a severe hypochondriac.
Oh, man, that is a recipe for disaster.
Totally. The reader just doesn't have the training to know which theories were rejected and which were adopted. They will just get deeply, permanently confused by the discarded ideas.
So he argues the Talmud is exclusively a tool for advanced scholars and judges who are actively making legal rulings. Basically, by banning the Talmud, he's saying people can't be trusted to watch the sausage get made.
Exactly. The friction of the debate is too risky.
Yep.
He just wants to hand them the final packaged law.
And he finds the perfect vehicle for that packaging in Maimonides, the Rambam.
Yes, the absolute center of gravity for this entire curriculum is the 12th century philosopher and legalist Maimonides. He mandates reading one chapter a day of Maimonides' magnum opus, the Mishneh Torah.
And he uses Maimonides' own introduction to justify this sweeping curriculum change, doesn't he?
He does. Maimonides explicitly stated that he wrote the Mishneh Torah to summarize all of the oral law. He gathered the sprawling, chaotic debates of the Talmud and distilled them into clear, definitive rulings.
Specifically so that a person wouldn't need to read the Talmud or any other legal book to know how to live. He's saying, stop trying to read the raw transcripts of a Supreme Court debate.
Right, you're going to misunderstand the metaphors. You're going to get seduced by the dissenting opinions. Just read the final executive summary.
But here's where it gets really interesting. He doesn't just promote Maimonides. He meticulously curates exactly which editions of Maimonides you are legally allowed to read.
Because the paranoia about contamination extends even to his heroes. He knows that over the centuries, texts get altered by copyists, either by accident or through deliberate forgery.
So he insists you only read specific, rigorously academic editions of Maimonides' philosophical works, like The Guide for the Perplexed and The Sefer HaMitzvot.
Yeah. He specifically demands using the editions edited by Yosef Kapek or the Blau editions for Maimonides' letters. He explicitly warns his readers against using any editions that might contain forged letters.
He is terrified of someone using Maimonides' name to smuggle bad ideas into his walled garden. And you really see the extent of this paranoia in the books he actively bans in this section.
Like the Sefer Hachnuk.
Exactly. He forbids reading the Sefer Hachnuk, which is wild because this is a hugely popular medieval work that methodically explains the reasons behind the commandments. It seems like a perfectly rational book.
It does. But the author bans it because the Sefer Hachnuk relies heavily on the writings of another major medieval rabbi, the Ramban, Nachmanides.
And our author accuses the Ramban of being steeped in what he dramatically calls a cursed Christian Kabbalah, which let's explore the mechanism of that accusation because it sounds bizarre to accuse one of the greatest medieval Jewish rabbis of spreading Christian theology.
It sounds crazy, but it comes down to how the author views the nature of God. Maimonides, the author's hero, believed in an absolutely unified, indivisible, unknowable God. No parts, no emotions, pure unity.
Okay.
But Kabbalah, the mystical tradition which Ramban introduces in his commentaries, often speaks of the Sephirah. These are 10 divine emanations or aspects of God that interact with the world.
So where Maimonides sees a perfect single unity, the mystics see a dynamic system of divine attributes.
Right. And to our strict rationalist author, dividing God into 10 interacting aspects looks horrifyingly similar to dividing God into a trinity.
Oh, I see.
He views the Kabbalistic concept of the Sephirah as a fractured Godhead. To him, it is polytheism smuggled in through the back door. That is why he equates Ramban's mysticism with Christian theology. It's the ultimate intellectual betrayal.
The reverse osmosis filter is just working overtime here. strip out the Midrashic folklore of Rashi, strip out the messy debate of the Talmud, strip out any commentator tainted by the mystical emanations of the Ramban.
Strip it all out.
But you don't build a mind of pure steel, a completely stripped of all these influences, just to sit quietly in a library, right? Like, what kind of human being is this curriculum actually trying to produce? What is the end game here once the mind is purified?
Well, the author is trying to engineer a highly specific type of psychological architecture. He wants to forge a mind capable of achieving pure, untainted reverence for God, entirely divorced from the crutches of superstition, magic, or emotional manipulation.
Which explains his incredibly minimalist approach to ethics. I mean, for a curriculum so dense with rules and daily reading quotas, his section on ethical development is surprisingly brief.
Extremely brief. He says you only need one single book on ethics for your entire life, Jovat Halavavak, or Duties of the Heart, written by the medieval Spanish thinker Urbano Bache ibn Pacuada.
That's it. Just read that one book on repeat from beginning to end forever.
Yeah. Because for the author, true ethics aren't found in a sprawling library of self-help books or emotional mystical tracts about the soul. True ethics are found in rigorous internal discipline, philosophical reflection, and rational devotion.
And he lists a very tightly controlled roster of safe thinkers who align with this mission, the approved allies.
Right. We heavily discussed Maimonides and Ibn Ezra. He also includes Sadia Gaon, but with a massive glaring caveat.
Oh, yeah. The Kapak edition rule again?
Exactly. You are only permitted to read the Kapag edition of Sadia Gaon's commentary on the Sefer Yetzirah. He insists on this to ensure you understand it as an ancient book about physics and the natural creation of the world, and not as a foundational text for mysticism.
He also approves of the Rif, Maimonides' son Abraham, and the Mary.
Though even the Mary gets a stern warning.
Right. The author criticizes the Mary for occasionally agreeing with what he describes as the power-hungry French Ashkenazis.
And this detail is fascinating because it highlights how deeply historical and geographic rivalries shape his curriculum. He views the Spanish Andalusian rationalist tradition as pure.
But he sees anything influenced by the French or Eastern European traditions as inherently vulnerable to mystical contamination.
Exactly. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this sets the stage for the final step of his program. The call to arms.
Yeah, he argues that once a person has spent years studying this exact curriculum, completely isolating their mind from consistent errors, they are required to take action. They are instructed to go to war.
He literally commands his followers to write articles, tear down false beliefs, and do absolutely everything in their power to destroy and eradicate the mystical Zohar from the world.
It is a lifelong ideological holy war. He doesn't just want to protect his students from the Zohar, he wants to eliminate the text from existence. Let's unpack the Zohar briefly for you listening, just to understand his terror.
Sure.
The Zohar is the foundational work of Kabbalah. It's a sprawling, deeply esoteric, mystical commentary on the Torah, full of secrets about the structure of the universe, angels, demons, and the cosmic impact of human actions.
And for this author, the Zohar is the ultimate pathogen. He views it as the primary vehicle that dragged magic, polytheism, and irrational superstition into a religion of law and reason.
He believes the Zohar fundamentally corrupted the nation's worldview. So this incredibly strict, uncompromising study regime isn't just about personal enlightenment, it's active armor.
Yes, he is forging intellectual soldiers capable of fighting off the darkness of irrationality with supreme logical clarity.
Honestly, it sounds utterly exhausting. I mean, imagine waking up every single day terrified that reading the wrong footnote or entertaining a poetic metaphor for a few seconds too long will spiritually damn your soul and shatter your entire worldview.
It sounds incredibly stressful. But that is the cost of his intellectual purity. It is the ultimate pursuit of absolute certainty in a world that is inherently chaotic and uncertain.
Yeah. Well, let's summarize the walled garden we've explored today in Chen Shalhoub's 2026 manifesto. We've mapped out a highly restrictive intellectual diet designed to systematically eliminate doubt.
It demands daily biblical study anchored only by strict translation.
It institutes a total ban on Rashi to avoid the seamless blending of folklore and literalism. It commands the layman to abandon the radioactive debates of the Talmud, replacing it entirely with the clean, unified rationalism of Maimonides' executive summaries.
And of course, it bans any text with a hint of mystical influence, culminating in a lifelong crusade to eradicate the Zohar.
The author isolates the mind, completely sterilizing the inputs to guarantee the outputs. And look, even if you fundamentally disagree with this author's extremist, and clearly a massive portion of the traditional Jewish world completely rejects it, there's something universally compelling about his underlying premise.
There really is.
Because in an age where algorithms constantly feed us a chaotic, endless stream of truth, half-truth, and total fabrication, what would actually happen if you ruthlessly curated your inputs? What if you applied that reverse osmosis filter to your own media diet and strictly limited yourself to sources you genuinely deeply trust?
It is an appealing thought experiment, especially today. But it raises an important question you have to ask yourself, bringing us right back to that glass of perfectly purified water you mentioned at the start.
Right.
If you build an impenetrable intellectual walled garden to protect yourself from every single bad idea, does that absolute sterile certainty actually make your mind stronger? Or does it ultimately make you fragile, completely unable to cope when you inevitably encounter a beautiful, complex, or messy idea that doesn't fit neatly into your carefully curated box?